So I guess we'll start with the Situationists. You know, obviously your work is very, very informed by the Situationists. Why do you think that they're important and relevant today?
Yeah, good question. They were trying to do theory and practice together, and that strikes me as significant. They were trying to combine critical theory and the avant-garde and the everyday. That also strikes me as a good thing. They were pretty free from temptations towards Stalinism and Maoism and all those other things that were, you know, sort of the diseases of the time, so to speak, on the left. So, and also they were kind of funny and had some style, and that was appealing, and extra institutional. So there's a pathway there that's kind of not as completely refusing to be institutionalized as people imagine, but they have some independence and some autonomy from the university, political parties, and the art world. And it struck me there were lessons in that as well. So yeah, if you want to, you know, to take two steps forward, sometimes you need to take a step back, and they struck me as interesting people to step back towards.
Yeah, I mean, totally. The when Occupy popped off at first, it really, like, instantly, like, it just, it instantly conjured the Situationists for me. Yeah, I feel like your How to Occupy Abstraction piece really captured that well. And one of the main things I think has really, really been lacking in the social movements of late is that style and poetry and flair that the Situationists had. Like, there was nothing sarcastic about Occupy. There's nothing sarcastic about the tar sands. How are we ever going to have a social movement that's, you know, fun again?
I think Guy Debord put it well, which is to be at war with the whole world lightheartedly. And that last is the difficult bit to do, to not lose that sense of joie de vivre, you know, that there's something important about everyday life lived well. But it's to try to connect the specific and the everyday solutions to the question of totality, that, you know, if we do actually mine the tar sands and extract, you know, hydrocarbons from it, we're kind of fucked. So this is a serious business. But to not kind of get worn down in the face of that, to not be kind of stupefied by that, but to sort of keep alive that gap between, you know, what can be thought and what needs to be done, and to keep open, you know, the possibility of, you know, the question of what does it mean to live well in a way that isn't about, you know, consumerism and the glittering prizes and all that bullshit. You know, it's kind of important to keep those modest goals in mind as well.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny. I was talking to a friend recently who's like, you know, an activist that I respect so much. And he's just like, you know, how do you do it, man? How can you be so pissed at everything all the time and not, you know, go crazy? Like, you're the only one I know who's just pissed about everything. And I'm like, dude, I'm not pissed about anything, man. I don't know why, but none of it affects me emotionally. It's all, like, you know, material. It's like I care about everything. I don't know. I don't get obsessed or upset or worked up about it. And I wonder if that's just because I've read Guy Debord, these books, like 1,000 times, and I just forgot what was in them, you know?
Well, it's everybody's emotional relation to the realities of the world is going to be different. And it's not like you can prescribe one. You know, it's not like you can say to someone whose, you know, response to the world is anger that you shouldn't be angry, because it's part of that person's being, you know. But that there are a range of ways of handling, you know, effectively, you know, what it is one feels about an impossible world, you know, an unendurable world. So yeah, there are different sorts of resources, and art is one of those, is it not? That one of the things one needs a little bit of art and a little bit of poetry for is to find that mode of relating your particular and contingent being and needs and desires, you know, to the sort of the negative space of the totality of, you know, a world at war with itself.
Yeah. it's too true, man. It's too true. All right, you have a new book out. It's called Telesthesia, which I've been reading, and I fucking love it. It's funny, it's thoughtful, whatever. How do you define telesthesia?
Telesthesia means perception at a distance, and that prefix tele is like in television and telescope and telephone, and the esthesia is like in anesthetic. Anesthetic means to not feel, right, or not perceive, rather, to not perceive. So tele at a distance, esthesia, which is also aesthetics, you know, is to perceive. So what's the effect on how the world is organized of the technologies of perception at a distance, of which, you know, telegraph is the first one historically. And what it did was it separated the flow of information from the flow of things. You know, information can move more quickly and hence becomes the layer that organizes the world of things. And to me, that's what the modern world is about, is that break. And we're kind of living out the consequences. And it's, you know, everybody obsesses about the latest frickin' iPhone or whatever, but the real break was the telegraph. That's when this whole world starts to have that dual character. And where what I would call a kind of third nature of how information is organized splits off from the second nature of, you know, buildings and trees and roads and all that built form that we live in. And both of which, of course, are sort of extracting more than we can sustain out of a nature that underlies both of them. So how is that sort of three-part world organized? That would be the central question of telesthesia.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's like, I'm sure you do as well. I mean, we all rely so much on technology for everything we do. And before I moved to Denver, I spent 2 years living like in a canyon, and we had no internet, no cell phone service, you know, like it was really difficult to, you know, be connected. And, you know, so we would spend our days looking at the birds and bathing in the creek and picking wild berries and making jam from cactuses. And then when we moved to Denver, you know, I'm back in the city. I'm online. I'm selling shit online. I'm researching things online. I'm downloading stuff. I'm in front of a computer all day, and when I'm not in front of my computer, I'm taking a shit with either my iPad or my iPhone, and it's like these things are never out of my sight, but yet I'm realizing like how, you know, technology's always been with me, and it's like it's a really positive thing, and it's a really negative thing, and it's a really complicated thing to talk about and think about. And so I just wonder like what how do we find a balance with all of this? Like, what, like, where are we headed, you know? Like, how is it, like, they say it's changing the way that our neurons are connecting to each other.
Yeah, like, I work with cognitive scientists who are really skeptical about that kind of claim. That's one of the things my university does. Well, the tendency is to want, technology, good or bad. You know, like, we have a moral frame of reference. I think the first useful thought is it's part of our species being and always was. You know, we're the tool-making animal. And what made us possible was, you know, those, you know, flint knives. It's always been part of what we are. We're a kind of assemblage of these things. And the next thought would be, The desire to sort of not have it and to get away from it, you know, is a kind of healthy one, and one needs to try to see what world all those technologies sort of shield you from and make unavailable and make you unaware of. You know, I live here in New York City, and people literally walk down the street looking at their iPhone, you know, and it's like watching a Charlie Chaplin film. They'll like walk straight across the street and the cars like whiz by around them. Completely oblivious, and it's like people get just freaking run over doing that every day here, somewhere, and it's that inability to perceive. So that's one side of it. But the other side of it is there's, you know, nearly 7 billion people on the planet now. That is completely inconceivable, other than as a kind of anthill made out of technology. You know, that's what makes it possible. And the only paths to a sort of endurable future are going to pass through some kind of technology. So maybe it's a question of trying to figure out what the space of possibility of technologies are, as opposed to the particular things that they've been made to do. And then the second question is, why do we only get these technologies with all these possibilities in these restricted and limited forms? And that would steer you towards questions about how the military is one of the sources of designing of these things, or that we get them because it's really just a way to extract value. It's just about commodification. So they're not really being applied directly to making the world inhabitable. They're being applied, you know, really to power and profit, where livability is a secondary effect that we temporarily and partially get from them. So one has to sort of ask that question, or that two-part question, you know, what's the larger space of what it could do? Why do we not get it in its full form? But then can we return to that? How do you then start at the conceptual level and then also at the practical level? How do you just repurpose things? It's a version of situation as détournement. Can you take technologies and create other purposes for them? Can you hack them? That becomes an important question.
Well, you know, it just came out that, you know, the I don't know if it's the FCC or whoever, they're trying to make it so you actually can't. You know, in Europe, you can unlock your iPhone and you can do anything with it. But in America, if you want to hack your iPhone and install Linux on it, you know, you can go. It's a felony now.
Mm. Well, you know, as I wrote in Hacker Manifesto, information wants to be free, but is everywhere in chains. It's part of just the ontological property of how information works. Once you get the technological layer right, that it just wants to be cheap and free and plentiful. But we keep turning to commodification, that, you know, these things are being sold to us really just to extract profit or even rent. It's not even profit anymore. You know, it's like, how do you get a rent out of a movie that someone made half a century ago that we're just refusing to give back to the people whose desires and imagination it really is part of? You know, so that's the thing, is that we get increasingly oppressive legal and technical regimes, but they're kind of artificial impositions on what a technology could do if it was freed from those kind of constraints. So there are, I don't want to make it sound like even that potential technology is the solution to everything. It's not magic. It's tools, you know. It's tools to be applied to tasks of living, you know, sustainable and equitable lives. It's not the answer. It's just part of the set of things that one needs to work on.
Yeah, I mean, do you have an iPad?
No, I don't, actually. Mate, because I've been broke for since frickin' since December, so I'll inevitably get one, but probably to read a whole bunch of PDFs from. But just don't ask me where I got the PDFs.
Well, it's fun. It's like I just got the iPad Mini, which is only $300, but it's like, I mean, it's changed my life. I mean, even my wife, who refused to get an iPhone, like we both got iPad Minis, and you know, with it. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with how music software works. Like, when you're using Ableton Live, you know, you have to get your MIDI instrument and attach every single knob to a thing, to a sound and an effect, and it's a pain in the ass. Whereas with the iPad, you just open it up, and you actually have a virtual instrument with all the knobs right there on the machine, and it's like, it's totally made beat making, and it's opened up brand new possibilities for how music can be made, and all these new kinds of music apps where you can see the sound wave and you can play with it right on the screen. And it's, I mean, the possibilities that are being opened with these new machines are, it's amazing. But at the same time, it's more time in front of a screen. And I think that's the thing that drives me crazy, is how much time we're spending in front of screens. And when you try to get away with it, we try to get away from it and, like, you know, not use a screen. Like, what are you going to type up essays on a typewriter? You know? So it's fucking...
Well, our relations to these things can be kind of contradictory. So, you know, some of my students are still handwriting their weekly notes, but then they photograph the notes with their iPhone and send me a picture of their notes. right? It's like, what? Why don't you just write it native on the screen, you know? Like, but somehow, you know, that doesn't seem like a logical idea, you know? So I often wonder, there might be anachronisms and strange backwaters in our relation to these things. But yeah, I mean, I spend all my time in coffee shops working on a laptop, and I look around and everyone else is doing exactly the same thing. And it's part of telesthesia because we're often in contact with other people in the process of doing it, right? I mean, I'm talking to you now, and we're in different cities, and this will be heard by people in yet more cities. So we construct these spaces of community and sociality and so forth as well. So there's kind of a double side to the screen. It can also be a way to kind of create relationships. But is there a kind of an imbalance between them? Might be a question worth asking.
Yeah, and that's something I think about all the time is, like, you know, I remember in the night, like, I was going through my old notebooks from when I first started moving around and doing music. I had all these telephone numbers and addresses, like, written in these notebooks. And, like, you know, all these people with stars next to their name, like, call this person at 10, call this person at... And, you know, that was only 10 years ago, but yet people don't call each other anymore. Like, I didn't just call. It's not even proper ethics anymore to call someone. Like, I had to get on chat with you, like, ping you first, wait for you to respond, and then say, okay, are you ready? Yeah. And so it's like, can you think of any other examples of how, you know, this technology is, like, changing our ethics?
I mean, it's the thing about that is that I think different people have different zones of comfort and discomfort with communication and the social. I personally have always hated the telephone. There's something about it I really kind of dislike. So I kind of loved email. For me, you know, everybody has different senses of I'm comfortable with this kind of social relation and less so with that one. I personally always hated the telephone. So email was this godsend. It's like, I don't have to speak to people on the phone anymore so much. Great, I'll just organize my life through this. But then you have to learn that certain things can go horribly wrong with email. Misunderstandings can snowball in ways that they don't when you're having a verbal conversation. So you kind of learn the affordances of different modes of communicating. So yeah, it's not necessarily a bad thing. But maybe one of the things worth exploring is the idea, it's in Walter Benjamin, for example, of distraction. That these things do kind of fuel a sense of paying, like, limited partial attention to one thing after another. And it might make it harder to sit down and do one thing with a little more consistency. So that could be the part that gets harder. Whereas in the old days, you had no choice but to do that because you'd just be bored off your ass if you didn't create your own project.
Yeah. I mean, it's ADD is not even a... It's just a way of life now, I think. All right, so you... Another thing that I love about this book is the term the military entertainment complex. It has huge implications. So I'm wondering, A, are you a gamer? Like, do you play video games? I guess you can answer that first. Do you play video games?
Yes.
What?
No, not these days.
Mm-hmm. What are your favorite games in the last 10 years?
I have kids, so now it's all about what they want to play. And at the moment, we're playing Mario Kart.
Nice.
So, you know, me and the two kids can all play that together. That's a terrific game. Like, it really is a lot of fun, and it's nicely designed, and it's kind of classic. So that, and my son and I play Minecraft. So it's a little bit, you know, it's become very much around what my 9-year-old particularly wants to do with games, and then including my 4-year-old as well. So, you know, I really don't get to go and just fire up the first person shooter anymore.
Well, I think that's good. Those games, they just get crazier and crazy. I mean, you can get PTSD playing those fucking games. Minecraft is, I don't want to jump around too much, but yeah, Minecraft is really it's interesting because when you talk about how we're being conditioned to work in these games, I think Minecraft is like a really good example of a game that's not violent, that really encourages, you know, creativity, but at the same time, it's, you know, conditioning you to work at the same time. and that's something you talk about a lot. I don't know if you talk about it so much in, I mean, you talk about it in this book also. So what function, like, what do you have to say about that? How the relationship now between work and play in these video games?
There's a sense that play used to be this kind of great outside. It was like the thing you could get critical purchase on the world of work from, because it was kind of excluded. You had to leave your playful self behind and go to work. That's sort of less and less true now. And, you know, a lot of quote-unquote, you know, like good jobs, you know, in offices and with benefits and stuff, you got to be creative and innovative and all this kind of stuff all the time. You know, you have to bring that playful sensibility to work and make it functional. And then on the other side, people found a way to extract value from your playfulness. So every, you know, kind of keystroke doodling around on the internet becomes data on the basis of which somebody's going to figure out, you know, who wants what product and how to sell this and how to sell that. So it becomes a whole business model to sort of every activity that you're going to do becomes commodified, whether it's work or not. So that's kind of the downside of the way play got incorporated. But I think the way to think about something like a video game, there is something utopian about playing games. You know, we're always told that the promise of neoliberalism is that, you know, it'll be a level playing field. And it's sort of, we all know that's completely untrue, that if you start in the 1%, you're going to end up there. But games are a place where the promise of a level playing field is almost actually usually kept. You know, you start the game in exactly the same place as everybody else who starts the game. And you really did get there on your merits. You know, whatever you did in the game, you did it. It's not somebody else, you know, sort of giving you a leg up. And even cheats are part of games. It's just a different rule set that you can opt into or not. So I think there is a weird sort of utopian side to why people like games. It's the place where the sort of neoliberal promise is actually kept. And that gives it a little bit of critical purpose against a world where the level playing field's a myth. It's not really true.
I mean, I agree on a lot of levels of that, but there's also that, I don't know if you ever played Warcraft. Did you ever play World of Warcraft?
Yeah.
So, like, that's the kind of game where, like, you know, if you're a rich dude who doesn't want to spend, you know, 200 hours grinding up to level 80, you can go on eBay and you can buy a level 80 character for, you know, $500 from some Chinese guy who's working in it, who's a prisoner in a Chinese prison, who's, you know, being forced at gunpoint to mine for gold. I never really
liked the massively multiplayer game. That's one of the reasons, because none of that is actually game. You know, it's the kind of incursion into the game of entirely other values. And there was, of course, resistance to that for a while in that community, and still unease about it, because that's where the contradiction starts to become kind of clear. Well, of course, the other reason I don't like massively multiplayer is, like, I live in New York City and I work in a university, right? I talk to 40 people every single day whose names I don't remember. I have to know stuff about them. It's like I'm in 7 guilds already. Just in everyday life, I do not need more social in my life. So to me, play was, I'm going to play with one person or just me and the machine. You know, it's like it's a break from a heavily, heavily socialized work environment. Because I think for a lot of people, it's the opposite. It's the appeal of the guild sort of situation of massively multiplayer. You can have this social life that takes you out of alienation and a connection to people and so on, and that could be appealing.
Did you ever? I sent you an article about Eve Online. Had you ever heard about that? The Bernie Madoff scheme on Eve Online, where these people had, in order to get, like, the end game cruisers, like the big battleships, you have to, you know, form these giant corporations and mine asteroids, and, you know, you can't do it on your own, so you have to form a corporation. And so this guy formed a corporation and, you know, got the equivalent of, you know, about $100,000 or $200,000 in the game to build these battleships. And then once he had all the money, he closed the corporation and pulled out. And with Eve Online, you can actually translate the currency in the game into real life money. So this guy cashed out with $100,000, and people were freaking out, and they contacted the game, and the game was like, look, this is capitalism. This is how the game was meant to be played. Like, this guy won.
Yeah, these things, like, they're interesting social phenomena, and it's one of the things a relatively new technology will do, is that most technology is invisible. Like, we don't know how dependent we are on it. But when you have a new one, then you have to ask all of the old social and ethical and political questions all over again. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, is that you get to sort of, you know, there's a little bit of a pulling back of the curtain that, well, it's always like this. But what I have to say about that one, what do you mean translated into real money? What makes you think money is real? Like, isn't that what's interesting about these things, is the fiction of money becomes really quite clear. It's like, oh, it's a game. Everybody just thinks this stuff has value because it's scarce. It has no other quality. It's just scarce and quantifiable. That's sort of it. Oh, real money's like that. Yeah? It's a social convention. It's not actually a thing. So there's like little moments of enlightenment that you can have if you sort of pursue these apparent contradictions and see that they're already at work in the rest of your everyday life, old style. We just don't notice it so much because it's now just common sense that, well, money is money and a machine's a machine or whatever.
The desert of the real.
Yeah.
All right, well, anyway, I want to go back to the military entertainment complex. How do you define the military entertainment complex?
Yeah, I did not coin that term, and I haven't been able to find out who did. I heard Brenda Laurel say it at SIGGRAPH in 1991 and appropriated it. And it's an update of the idea of the military-industrial complex. While there's still manufacturing in the United States, it's not really what this economy is about. So is there a way that the kind of spectacle and the military become, in a sense, one industry based on the instrumentalizing and commodifying of information technologies? It seems to me to be a key part of it. And that, you know, Paul Virilio is good on this, that what's really central to how the military operates is perception, is being able to locate and identify what you're going to call an enemy at a distance. So telesthesia is a really, really key part of how the military works. The pilotless drone is just an absolute emblem of how that works, but it's not the only one. There are many other forms. So it was military entertainment complex was a way of thinking about that together, that this is, you know, kind of Hollywood plus Wall Street plus the Pentagon is essentially what power now is in this world.
I actually have a very good friend who was the liaison for the American Army video game, and he went to West Point. And when he went down there, you know, they taught him how to fly drones. They let him drive around in a missile launcher. They showed him all these drone experiments and then turned to him and asked him to help them recruit for the Army through this video game that they were making. And, you know, he felt like they were whining and dining him with all this fucking violent shit and trying to, like, you know, woo him into, like, okay, now will you give us the 16-year-olds, you know? And he was horrified. He ended up, actually, after this game, he ended up quitting and going to work for the people who do Sonic the Hedgehog and all this other stuff. But, you know, it was known in the 90s that if you're a Hollywood director and you wanted to make a movie that involved, helicopters or tanks, like, you'd have to run your script by the Army, and then you would get free access to battleships and cruisers, and, you know, that's why these movies look more and more just like military ads. But when we combine that with the military entertainment complex and how the Army and the military are actually collaborating with game designers to create an experience that makes people want to do this, you know, where is this headed? I mean, are we really entering this Ender's Game situation?
Well, we're already in it. Isn't that the thing? We're already in a world that essentially uses telesthesia, perception at a distance, to try to monitor the world, preemptively identify possible sources of threat and neutralize them in advance. And, you know, it's taken us nowhere good. And, of course, once you have that kind of technology of perception, It's like if you've got a hammer, everything's a nail. If you've got surveillance, then everything is a threat. So we end up with this, you know, kind of one-dimensional view of the world, which is actually making, in some senses, making America a scarier place to be because everybody freaking hates us.
Yeah.
We just shot their grandkids for no apparent reason. So it doesn't go anywhere good. But it's not... I don't want to see the military piece as all that separable from the rest. It's part of a continuum of practices. And one has to kind of take it whole, in a sense. So one would like to think the Pixar movie is something separate from the military simulator, but it's part of a range of technologies that have been used to do a limited range of what it is they could possibly be doing for us. You know, that's the part that strikes me as a little terrifying. One has to say, though, that taking very large data sets and massaging them into a model and then kind of representing through an algorithm what might be happening, that's also how we know that climate change is real, right? Is through exactly the same technologies, you know, or things from the same family of technologies help us to perceive a world that we need to see as there and real. So that's the thing. It's not the technology, it's the applications. It's how they're limited in their functions and attached to specific things. You know, that would be the part that alarms me. You know, it's not like there's a kind of a retreat from the technical as a whole, because as I said earlier, you know, I think the technical is part of our being. Like, we don't exist separately from it, and that would be the key sort of intellectual breakthrough, is to sort of try to not see it as something separate. It's integral to us.
Yeah, well, my governor doesn't believe in global warming, so we use the word alleged when we talk about global warming here in Colorado.
We're humans, you know, as says truth is the last thing we want, you know. There's something to be said for, you know, trying to refine us into like a better state of delusion might be more the goal. We could have better delusions than these ones, more helpful and useful and livable ones.
I agree. I totally agree with that. I love that. I was watching this Christopher Hedges Death of Liberalism documentary the other night, and in it he was talking about how it's grim as fuck, and I don't really agree with all of his conclusions, specifically about fascism rising in America. But one of the things he talks about is how, you know, with reality TV and, you know, the death of print, that we're like, you know, we're moving out of a phase of real journalism and moving into a phase where everything is like reality based and it's opinion and emotion, and, you know, everyone is pretty much entitled to their own facts. And I mean, I see that playing out now in Colorado with fracking. They just keep repeating like these, like the same lies. Like, they repeat these same lies so often that I almost start believing them. I don't know. I guess that's just a comment, but I mean,
Yeah, you know, like Chris Hedges is an honorable man. I've seen him speak about things, and obviously not everybody agreed with what he thought about Occupy, for example. But he's coming from a place where, you know, he was a journalist for a major news organization, and kind of quit it. But, you know, one has to ask, was it even already doing what it was supposed to be doing? Hang on a sec, I just got somebody at the door.
Within about 10 minutes? Yeah.
After all, it was New York Times that got us into the Iraq War, yeah? Or it's one of the things. They gave it the green light. So I want to be a little bit skeptical about any particular decline narrative, as if, you know, it's not as if things were all that great 20 years ago or 50 years ago. So that would be my kind of caution about that. But one always, I think, has to be a little vigilant about just exactly what kind of delusion one might be entering into. And maybe, you know, I'd be inclined to agree with him. There is a kind of fascist cast to some of the places we're heading.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with what you're saying. I don't check blogs or newspapers anymore. I have a Twitter feed of activists all over the world, and I actually think it's better to just get information direct from people who actually know what's going on.
I mean, the internet makes the kind of social id much more visible than it used to be, but it was always there.
Okay,
there are boys being fascists and haters, and all that stuff has always been there. It's just much easier to find that than it used to be. And in some ways, that's a good thing, because you can actually measure it and monitor it and figure out what its arguments are and how to address them in ways that actually used to be quite difficult. So that would be the, to be a little cautiously optimistic about it, that would be the upside, is you go find the enemy and how they're organizing and what they're saying in ways that used to be a little harder to do.
I just have a couple more questions and then we'll be done.
Sure.
What do you think of Ray Kurzweil and his quest for immortality?
It's kind of the crazy sci-fi side of how you can think about technology. And it's kind of interesting metaphorically. There's a kind of confusion. And incidentally, it's not a new idea. This is 19th century Russian stuff. It's a kind of ancient thing that's got this new American cast. But it sort of makes, in this very literal way, an image of something that's actually quite real, which is, you know, where we extrude kind of shells out of ourselves as if we were like crustaceans or something, and then inhabit them. We kind of are. We're like coral as a species. Yeah, I'm looking out the window at coral, these huge multi-story buildings. We just don't do it very well, and not so much immortality, but longevity for our species being is about extruding a better shell, and that shell is made of hard and soft technology, in a sense. It's social systems and technical systems. So thinking about ways to do that more sustainably and more equitably, you know, that's really the problem. But there's the singularity guys, they kind of mistake it as this individual goal. And that is always the problem, is to see it just as self. You know, we don't exist as individual isolated units. We're a social species. And that's the missing part.
Yeah, I would take the shot. I would take the nano shot to live forever and go to Mars, definitely.
Well, who wouldn't? Yeah.
My wife wouldn't. She's like, if you take the shot and go to Mars, I'm not. You're going to have to bury me. And I'm like, fine. Sorry. That sucks.
Unfortunately, the real conversations are at the other end. You know, we could be down to a few million people living up above the Arctic Circle, you know, in 200 years' time. It's really more the thing to focus on.
Yeah, and then you're just drowning eternally in the ocean.
Trying to rebuild civilization on water worlds. You know, good for that.
Which, by the way, is a very fun thing to do in Minecraft.
Exactly.
Building underwater cities. All right, so the Panopticon was a prison, an experimental prison where, you know, there was shade so you could see into every cell, but there was never anybody behind the shades looking into the cells, but people behaved because they thought someone was watching them. And, you know, I always, you know, I think about that with pretty much everything. But then you introduced the Transopticon. You know, what is the Transopticon? Is it worth trying to fight? You know, has the spectacle taken over? You know, what can we do to resist the Transopticon?
Yeah, that, I mean, it has to be said, you know, one of Jeremy Bentham's famous pamphlets was called The Panopticon or New South Wales. I'm from New South Wales. It's in Australia. Like, the British didn't build the Panopticon. What they settled on was transportation. They had the technology to ship people from one side of the planet to the other, so that's what they did. So there's a kind of, in some sense, misreading of history. I think that the techniques of transportation are more like the origin of where we are now. This kind of mobile approach to, it's not really about enclosing space, which is Foucault's model. It's about kind of extending control outward into space, so that would be the Transopticon. It's kind of always been bleak. One wouldn't necessarily want to see this as the the end times in that regard. You know, one is always looking for the space of exile when you can start to rebuild everyday life on another basis. You know, and is that not the task?
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the end times, because part of my question in there was talking about Baudrillard, you know, basically saying the spectacle's taken over, we've lost, we've got to give in to the ecstasy of communication, it's all that's left. You know, and I think he wrote that before the internet was really even a thing.
The thing about Baudrillard is there's a kind of a passionate longing for an impossible contact with the real, and he sort of thinks, you know, the gates to paradise are locked, but you can get in around the back, as Kleist says, and it's the fatal strategy. Are there ways that you show exactly the lack of purchase language has on the world by kind of turning it on itself over and over again? So that there is a kind of useful strategy in Baudrillard. Like, it's not all, you know, he's thought of as more pessimistic than he kind of actually is in that regard. I see him as someone who fought the good fight all the way through to the end. I must have a lot of respect for him. But he's not been read that way.
Yeah, no, I like his ideas as well. I like a lot of the stuff he says. All right, last question. So with all that we're talking about technology and utopianism, I was recently watching this David Graeber speech on technology and bureaucracy. Have you seen that?
No.
It's really awesome. And he basically is talking about how, like, the reason why everybody's upset now is because we don't have flying cars and we don't work 4 hours a day, and, like, the utopia never arrives. We're working longer and harder and we're never going to have flying cars. And he kind of goes into, like, you know, talking about Stalin and how the last great thinker of, you know, who was really trying to solve the world's problems was Stalin, and trying to, you know, beam energy from the sun to create energy for the whole world, and, you know, grow algae on the oceans to feed everyone. And, you know, if we all know how that ended. And, you know, there's other utopian ideas out there, like stuff like the Venus Project, or kind of Peter Kropotkin's idea of how to organize a society, or even, you know, the new communism put forth by people like De Quin. And so I just wonder, like, you know, what are your thoughts on a different way of kind of, you know, structuring a society? Can we move towards a more directly democratic world where we use technology? Is that a bad idea? I mean, are we always going to need representative politics? Can we live without them? Can technology provide new models for how we can structure ourselves? And I think that's, like, the main thing that Graeber was getting at in his speech, is that, you know, we put people in space, we build cities in the desert, we've got people living in Antarctica, you know, we can go to we could build a city on the center of the ocean if we wanted to, but yet we...
Yeah. So no, he's right about that, but... if you think about the enormous potential of what could be done with the forces of production that we have, then that these relations of production are an absolute fetter becomes more and more obvious. That we're just kind of squandering this kind of planetary wealth on what exactly? You know, on what? We can feed people, we can house people, we have the tools. Why are we not doing it? Does it not get starker and starker and clearer that that's where we are? So yeah, absolutely right. The future is a resolvable problem. Why are we not resolving it? It's you know, in a word, it's capitalism. Yeah, it's a set of relations that steer resources towards things other than what's good for our species being. Simple as that.